Allensworth, reel 8.
And I said, what am I to do with you? I said, oh, I'll have my discharge, sir. So I said, but you've only just arrived. I said, I don't care. I said, I'm fed up with this place. I said, I want to be out of it. And I said, well, I wasn't fit to go back to my unit. All right, so eventually, I said, he compromised and he said I could go to the command depot at Ripon.
Mm.
And I got my discharge papers and my railway warrant.
Mm. Before we go on to Ripon, it sounds from your description of the hospital that they were more concerned with strict adherence to military regulations than they were concerned about the treatment of the patients. But are there any other examples of the sort of military style in which the hospital was run that you can think of? I mean, was there a regular...
I was only there 4 days.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When you went into... Mm-hmm. When you went into... Yeah?
I met this sister as I came out the doctor's room, you see. She looked sort of satisfied, smirking. That sort of put him in his place, you see.
When
I had my dinner, and then I got my kit, you see, and And I'm marching up. I met her again. She said, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. She said, you're not, etc. And I've got my warrant and I've got my discharge. So I'm going. Good luck to you. Mm. I cleared off.
When you went into Manchester on your trips from this hospital, did you get any more insight in Manchester into the sort of civilian morale and civilian attitude to the war?
No. I didn't know anybody at all. I just had a walk around the place, that's all, and I don't remember anything of those 2 days in Manchester. I couldn't even tell you what I saw.
Okay.
All I wanted to do was get away from that place, you see.
When you got home to Hull on sick leave, what was your reception by your friends and your family?
Everybody was glad to see, you know, they sort of returned hero worship and all that sort of thing. I had to go around to all my relatives and such as that, you know. And I went into... a tool shop in Hull Caves. I wanted some pliers because the pliers that were issued by the army were literally useless for cutting wire under shellfire or any circumstances. If you had to be sawing at the blooming wire to cut it, you're wasting time. There was no side cutters on them, just, you know, straight jaw pliers.
Mm.
And I decided I went to buy these pliers and the shop was staffed mostly with girls by then. And the window displays were in sort of separate sections with an opening from behind, which was always locked for small tools. These pliers were in the window and they were marked 2 shillings and 9 pence, which is a good price in those days. But I thought I'd have them. They were blued steel, the blue's worn off. And one of the girls, I was in hospital blues, you see, said, well, those are the only ones they had. But she said, I'll get them for you. So she got them out. I thought, well, I'm not going to let the army claim these. I'll get my initials put on them. So I went down the side street to the saw shop where John Ringer was, one of the bosses, was there, and I knew him. I asked him, could he put my initials on these? He just tossed them up and down. He said, where do you get these from? So I said, I've just bought them. He says, we haven't done this since the war started. He says, these are German. So I said, well, I don't care. I said, they'll do me. He says, I'll say they will. He says, you can't buy any like this in this country.
Mm.
And so... he put them in a vice and I held the punch while he used a big heavy hammer to get punch me because he said they're so hard.
Mm.
And those will still cut wire today.
Mm.
There's just a little bit of a gap, but you can see through there.
While you were at home in Hull, did your friends and your family talk to you much about what was going on in France?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What kinds of things interested them?
Well, they were more inclined to be on the personal angle, you see.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't much interested in the progress of the war, just on how I'd been faring, that sort of thing, you see. Mm-hmm.
Did they seem to you to know very much about the war, what was going on in France?
Well, not particularly. I mean, they don't have the same point of view at home as you have in France, you see. Apart from anything else, they've got possibly a wider view, if less intense. You in France, you've only got a local view, but more intense of your own particular section of the front for, say, 2 or 3 miles either side. But, for instance, we down on the Somme, we didn't know much about what was going on up in Belgium, anything like that, you see. Mm. We didn't care. For mm. We had enough of problems of our own without thinking about other people's.
Mm. Did you find that the interest of your friends and family, or did you find in talking to them about the war that they had that their knowledge of it was inaccurate in any way?
No, they took their views from the paper mostly, you see, and to some extent from their own relatives, but you couldn't write much in letters, you see, because they're all censored. Mm. You were not allowed to send anything which might be of any value to the enemy. Mm-hmm. So, pretty general knowledge, I suppose. It wasn't.
So after you finished your home leave, you went to the...
North Camp.
North Camp, and this was the Royal Artillery Command Depot.
Yes.
You said there that this was an awful place.
I did. Yeah.
And that you volunteered to rejoin the battery because it was so bad. Well, what was wrong with it?
Well, it took me 5.5 hours from Hull. I left Hull about 5 o'clock and I got there about 10:30. And the NCO in charge of the guard promptly shoved me in the cells because in the guard room because I was supposed to be in at 10 o'clock, according to him. But it didn't say 10 o'clock on my pass. I just had to report on, was it January the 7th, I believe. Anyhow, in the morning, nothing's done to me. And while I'm in that night, I heard a familiar voice. And it was George Leake, one of the gunners out of my own subsection, who heard me coming, you see, with my voice. And he'd arrived sometime, you know, an hour or two earlier, a bit earlier. And it seems he'd been wounded after me and been in a different hospital, you see, so a shorter time. He'd arrived that same night. But however, the next day...
I think we better concentrate on one thing at a time. Yeah. What I'm trying to get out of you now is why you regarded the Northern Command Depot as so bad that you were happy to get back to France. What was it?
Well, the next day, all the newcomers were in before... a standing medical board. There were two or three officers there, and you filed past them. They were examining, I think about 100 in an hour at their rate. You went before them, and they said, what's the matter with you? And I said, gunshot wounds in the arm, in the neck and the jaw and the back. And they said, was I all right? I said, I couldn't open my jaws properly yet. So... he then said to me, well, go down to Market Square in Ripon this evening. He said, do you know it? I says, no, sir. I says, I only arrived last night in the dark, in a snowstorm and whatever. So go down there. He says, find the prettiest girl you can. He says, take her down a dark passage and get her to tickle you under the chin. He said, you'll soon open your jaw then. That's as true as I sit here. That's the advice he gave me. Mm. Next one. And I went on. Bloody disgusting.
What else was so bad about the place?
Well, you were... before breakfast. And some of these men were in there. They'd been suffering from malaria in hot climates. Take them out in the snow like that. There was, I think, about 90 sergeants... there, out of a total of 600 or 700 men. Well, what were all those sergeants doing there? The officer in charge, he was an old dugout.
Yeah.
Been retired, God knows how many years, and come back into the army. And he was all spit and polish, parade and that kind of thing. He came on parade one day. I've forgotten what he had to tell us. But he marched up and down like Napoleon... for a minute or two, with his hand across his chest like this, you see. And then he suddenly turned on and says, you men, he says, who have won honour and glory on the fields of battle in France and Flanders, get how I wish I could have been with you. And he banged his fist like, we gaped open mouth, you silly old devil. And so, the rations were simply appalling.
Worse than on the front?
Yes, definitely. For dinner, we used to get some days cold tinned rabbit, Australian tinned rabbit, and a soggy boiled potato. And this culminated one day in literally a mutiny.
Tell me about that. What happened?
When the ordnance officer came round, everybody was bombarding him, you know, with complaints. And so his name was Captain P.W.M. Bate, B-A-T-E. I can remember that. And the lieutenant who was with him, our section lieutenant, was off the fish docking up, but I can't remember his name. And so he came back with the this colonel and the sergeant major. And the colonel got up on a form to address us. There was about 500 or 600 men in that big concrete dining hall. And he started to speak, and they started rattling their knives and forks when they found he wasn't going to give us anything on the tin plates. The potato was colder by then, so it didn't matter. It couldn't get any colder. And the sergeant major shouted to somebody to stop it, you see. With that, somebody threw a potato from behind and hit him at the back of the neck with his potato. And that was the signal. There was a fusillade of wet boiled potatoes at them, and they retreated in disorder with potatoes splattered over them. And so there was a deathly silence after that. And after an interval, Captain Bate came back. He was a decent chap. And she got on the form and he said, I'm sorry you've taken the action which you have done, although we sensed that he agreed with us, you see. He said, I'm making arrangements to have another meal ready for you, see. And if you just wait, and it'll be served as soon as possible, you see, something like that.
So this was not only a mutiny, but it was a successful mutiny.
Yes, we got a better meal than we'd had before, you see. Mm. So then a night or two later, I suppose, in revenge, by the way, with no fires, they stopped that. They said the fuel situation was such that we couldn't have any fires. So we were out on parade in the morning. We came back. Sergeants, mess and officers, mess, they've got stoves going like hell, smoke going out, and we couldn't have one. So we used to raid the coal store 6 o'clock in the morning, draw lots, you know, to take turns each time, and climb over there, you see. The sentries were in with us, you see. They never stopped us. And raid the coal store, get coal like that. But about 2 o'clock in the morning, it was snowing again, the bugle started going. The corporal was in the next bed to me. He says, what's that? I said, it's the bloody fire call. Because we were trained on the bugle calls, you see, in 1915, although we didn't use them in France, of course. I said, what's on fire in the middle of a snowstorm? However, we sat tight, and we'd hear sounds of activity outside, you know, and shouting and going on, and then eventually the sergeant major came in. What the hell are we all? We hadn't moved, you see, so everybody was out waiting, so we got dressed and went outside, you see. They're all lined up there, everybody shivering. And then this old so-and-so started to address us again in the snowstorm about discipline and such as that at 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, after a bit, the rear ranks began to melt away in the snowstorm. You see, finally, they reckon he was left addressing the front rank only, who couldn't get away. Well,
what was the outcome of that?
Oh, he couldn't do much, really.
It sounds as if you had something close to complete anarchy on the camp.
It was. John Bull took this lot up. You were not allowed to... if you were found with a copy of John Bull, that was an offence. You were not allowed to send anything home, you see.
Why was John Bull regarded as...
Because he took up the cudgels on our behalf, you see. Somebody had written to him, it seems. But Horatio Bottomley, you won't remember that, John Bull. It was a paper which was... Horatio Bottomley was... he got time at finish. He was a twister, but by God, he got things done during his time. And you were not allowed to send parcels of some kind. I just forget what it was now. So they all had to be censored. Well, that was it. All your parcels had to be censored. So, right, monkey. The troops always have an answer, you know. So what they did, they started sending sweaty, mucky socks home, and the officers had only a pair of sweaty socks inside. There was a chap in our hut, a Jew. He suffered badly from trench feet, you know, and trench fever, that sort of thing. He could barely hobble, and there used to be a travelling medical board come every fortnight, I think. And this chap, he goes before this TMB, as we called it. He thought he'd get his discharge, because he was useless. And everything was going well, until one of these officers said, are you a Jew? And he said, yes, sir. Oh, B2, service abroad. He says, go to Khartoum and die there, or something like that, you see. Well, somebody, Joseph, who became a knight later, he was in Parliament at the time, and his people wrote to him and took the case up like that. But before anything more could be done, this chap died in the hut. We couldn't wake him when we came back one from parade one day. He was hot hardly, you see, because he couldn't go on parade. He couldn't walk hardly. He was in a coma. So I know the RAMC came and took him away. And he died.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they wanted this hushed up. They wouldn't give his people a free warrant to come up to the funeral, you see. They wanted going to bury him quick. We had a Whitbrown and sent money down there to get his people up there, you see. But before then, I'd gone, so I don't know what happened afterwards. Is that the end?